Hey folks, Alex Lokes here, and we are back with our May episode of Classic Camera Revival, and we are going to pick our poison. That's right, we are going to talk about the camera gear that we use for our favorite styles of photography, whether it be travel, portraiture, sports, kids' portraits, or even wildlife. So, let's get into this.
Coming to you live from Toronto, Canada, this is the Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to our show.
All right, so we are going to hit the streets with John Meadows.
Okay, and the camera I'm going to talk about is a combination. Like, I like to go out, you know, I have a bad back. I don't like going out with a lot of gear at this point. So going out with one camera, one lens really appeals to me. And I think I've talked about the Voigtlander before, but my Voigtlander R2M and the lens I got recently, 35mm 1.7 Voigtlander Ultron lens. It's a screw mount, but it mounts via an adapter. And I find that to be a lovely combination. It's just wide enough to not be too wide, because if you shoot everything with a 21 or 25, it starts to get that novelty factor.
The distortion.
Yeah. And with a 35, if you're careful and don't do close-up, you can do portraiture with it, if you're careful. And the fact also that it's 1.7, it's nice and fast. So that, I've gone out at night sometimes, you know, throw a roll of T-Max 400 in there, push it to like 1600 or so with a 1.7. There, you know, if you have any kind of light at all, you can shoot. And of course, because a rangefinder, you're not getting that mirror slap. And a 35, like, you can shoot down to, like, you know, 1/8, 1/15. You might not get 100% hit rate, but you'll be close enough. And Absolutely. Then my back thanks me at the end of the evening.
I'll bet. So do you zone focus?
Quite often, like during the day, like if I can, you know, stop down to, let's say, F8 or F11.
Okay.
Zone focus. And then, yeah, it's who needs autofocus when you don't understand how hyperfocal distance works?
Absolutely.
I was showing Donna that actually with her Leica before it disappeared out of her hands somehow. I was literally showing her the actual hyperfocal ideas. You set it, and the nice thing about the 3A is it has a separate viewfinder window, so you just compose your image and shoot, and there you go.
Absolutely. One thing I will add about the R2M or the rangefinders in general, I think they're great for street shooting and pretty casual quick shooting, because I find sometimes if I'm trying to use hyperfocal distance in an SLR, I'm looking through the viewfinder, and even though intellectually I know that hyperfocal distance will take care of it, I still feel that urge
absolutely.
To tweak the focus. Yeah. With the rangefinder, of course, there's no depth of field, so you have to trust that you set it right.
That's right.
And I just find that kind of approach changes the way I look at a scene.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Totally. In school, I was always taught F8 and B there, and that depending on the lens, that you could on F8, you can set it somewhere between like 5 feet and near infinity, depending on what usually 35mm lenses. You basically have that whole range in, at F8, and you don't have anything to worry about. So,
yeah.
Just looking here on my little Fed, I'll just have a quick little boo at the markings. And at F8, as Trevor was mentioning, I've got a 50mm F2 Jupiter. And I've got from 4 meters to infinity that there should be roughly in
focus.
Within
Absolutely.
Reasonable focus,
which is key for shooting on the street, because you, unless you're Leon, you don't really stop and ask someone for permission to shoot their portrait.
Yeah, exactly. And especially if you're shooting a scene, you don't really have time, because let's face it, you see a car smash into a fire hydrant, next thing you know, I've got a huge geyser. Believe me, I've actually seen photos of this. My grandfather caught it on a Vigilant Junior 620. I had the negative. It was wild. Middle of winter, huge geyser of water shooting up in the air. Could you imagine within minutes that today, that kind of scene would be unbelievably insane. There'd be people running everywhere. But if you're right there at the right time, you're not going to have time to focus. You just want to have it set, point, click, done, and get the shot.
Absolutely. Sticking in on the urban, there's a lot of people here who really enjoy New York City. It's a fantastic city, especially if you're a photographer, whether you're in Manhattan or anywhere in the boroughs. And We're going to talk with Bill Smith first about the kit that he brought to New York.
Okay. I fell in love with New York City when I was in high school. And again, it was before I really got serious into photography. It was during the deep, dark mid-80s when David Dinkins was in. And it was the gritty New York people remembered. Then I then went back in 2012. My brother was living and working in New York City for a few years, so I had a place to stay. And I wanted to take a kit with me. And I had some, again, I flew down. I flew the first time in Air Canada to LaGuardia. And so I had some restrictions in terms of size of camera bag. I took a Domke, little bit smaller, which I have with me today here at our session. It is a great camera bag. Yeah, they're not cheap, but they do fit under the majority of airline seats made by Bombardier, Boeing, Airbus, and Embraer. Worthy the investment. Two, you can, in my case, on the 2012 trip, I took down an Olympus OM-1N, a 51.8 MC Zoico lens, a 135-35 lens that I didn't bother using. I don't know why I took it with me. So I wound up just using the 50 and the 28 the majority of the time, and I also took my Rollycord 4 to cover off medium format. It all fits in the bag along with a pair of sunglasses, a light meter, film, a notebook, and of course, reading glasses. So again, it is the that was my travel kit to New York City. It's still, it was reasonably light that you won't feel like you're leaning to one side. Like some brave souls will take a Hasselblad kit with them, and then you just sort of say, no, travel light.
Absolutely. And in season one, I actually did a episode solo on traveling light when I was in Europe.
Yes, you did.
I drank a half bottle of French wine and was sitting next to a Commonwealth cemetery while I recorded it.
Because you made room for it in your camera bag, of course.
Absolutely.
Essentials.
It's a wine and camera bag at that point.
Yeah.
And it fit in his belly pretty well, too.
I also had a chance recently, about a year ago, to go to New York City for my honeymoon. And the camera I brought with is one that's not a stranger to CCR, and that is the Nikon FA. Now, this is a camera I first heard about on the Film Photography podcast, and I had a chance to, again, buy one from John Meadows. I've added on to it since then, and the accessory that really has helped me to make this one of my main travel cameras is the motor drive. And I got the actual motor drive, the MD15, which is designed for the FA. You can use other motor drives that are designed for the FM and the FE with it, but the MD15 is designed specifically for the FA. And what I really want to stress with traveling, and Bill touched into it, is the three-lens kit. You want a camera body and you want three lenses. You want something that's a little wider than normal or wide. In the case of New York, I brought the AIS Nikkor 35mm f/2.8, which
good
is
choice.
A sleeper lens, right? Most people will go for the slightly faster one, the f2, or even faster. But the 2.8 is still a fantastic lens. It stops all the way down to f22. I mostly shoot it around f8. Then you want that normal 50, in my case, the f4.5 AIS. And then you want a short telephoto. And for me, that choice is the infamous, or famous, 105 f2.5.
Oh,
yeah,
that is
105. I've seen you walking around with that one.
The 105 lens is the lens.
I would say
absolutely.
Famous.
The reason I go with the FA instead of, say, an FM2 is because I have access to that program mode. I can shoot it fully automated and just have to worry about the focus. And it gives me a chance to get the wide-angle shots of the cities. I've since added the 28 3.5 AI lens to my kit, which is also a fantastic lens. And again, you can get it cheaper because it's the f3.5 on the bottom end, but just as good as any other one. It's just not as fast. But again, if I'm shooting it outside, I'm at like f4, 5.6, f8 anyways, and then it doesn't really matter. Even with the motor drive, this camera is small, it's lightweight, and those three lenses, you will be able to get everything you need to, from getting architectural details on some of the buildings to getting the wide angle shots in like parks or just urban scenes anyways. Mm-hmm. And I actually found myself not using the 50. I stuck with the 35 and the 105 for most of my trip.
It's weird though, my brother, Alex Smith, sometimes he'll even advocate just rolling with a, when he's shooting Nikon, he'll just shoot with the 35 f2 and the 105 2.5, and it just becomes a two lens kit.
Yeah.
And he goes even, and he goes super minimalist. I think he's done that, I think, on one trip to back to New York since after moving back to Canada.
And my bag of choice when traveling, and again, I wish I had this this camera bag when I was in Europe, but the Peak Design Everyday Messenger bag. Because again, that gives me more room, but again, it fits under most airline seats or in overhead compartments. And when you're traveling to Europe to fight the French, and you have a giant suitcase and your musket and a ski kit, your carry-on becomes very secondary.
That's not something you actually usually hear in a sentence in today's world.
Traveling with my musket?
Well, traveling to Europe to fight the French carrying a musket. I mean, that just...
Well, that's because all it takes to beat the French is a musket.
Oh.
Ooh. Ooh.
To our friend Jacques at Targentix.
We're sorry.
Well, he's not really French. He's Quebecois.
Yeah.
True.
So he's,
we love you, Jacques.
Yeah. Hi, Jacques. It's interesting that you say that. I take a little bit of a different approach when it comes to travel photography. I'd like to go with a one-lens kit,
okay.
And it's usually a mid-range zoom. And my if it wasn't my newly acquired F6, it would have been my F5, probably, because it's fully automatic. I'm really lazy when I do travel photography. I was actually in New York last weekend, and... if I'm doing street photography or I don't want to screw around with manual focus. I'm just, you know, I don't manual focus enough as a photographer when it comes to fast moving action photography to be that good at it. So I take the lazy approach, and I on my F6 I put a 28-85 Nikkor lens, which is a 3.5-4.5 lens. Actually, excellent lens if you can find one.
Still not bad.
Yeah, it's a good. It's sharp edge to edge at both ends of the zoom. Believe it or not.
That's a lens I got to look for my N90S. Yeah,
it's a great lens. I think if you do have an F6 and you want to spend a little bit more money, you could get a 24-85 2.8, which is the newer version, which has got a little better contrast, that sort of thing. It's coated and that sort of thing. That's what's made for more optimized for digital. But the 28-85 is a spectacular lens, and I think for me when I'm traveling, it's. Very small bag. I have a small crumpler bag that basically fits an SLR, and that's it.
No, but James here, when I first met him and first started chatting with him, he was a portraiture photographer, from what I mostly knew him as. So what would you usually pick
sure.
for a portrait?
Sure. Well, I still am, I guess, primarily a portrait shooter. I've shot several weddings over the years. I've taught wedding photography at the college level. And I like shooting people. And for me, the gear of choice typically is medium format when it comes to shooting film. And that's my Hasselblad. And you know, I think when, at least in the Toronto area, when Hasselblad was, and it still is popular, but when, you know, in the early 90s, well, pretty much anywhere from the mid 70s to the late 90s when digital started coming out, and you know, you started getting into the D800 and some of these and now medium format digital cameras. Before that time, everyone shot a Hasselblad. And when you bought your Hasselblad kit... Well, most professional photographers shot a Hasselblad.
Oh.
Touché.
And when you bought your Hasselblad kit as a pro photographer, you basically used the 80mm lens that it came with as a paperweight, and you went out and you got yourself 150. And that's the...
Sonar?
Yeah, that's the Zeiss, the Carl Zeiss Sonar. It's an F4 150, and it was pretty much, or it is the pretty much pinnacle of portrait lenses for the 6x6 kind of world. Yeah, and it is
an excellent lens. I can't lie.
Yeah, oh no. I mean, it's the standard by which other portrait lenses are judged generally, and I think the majority of the pro photographer circuit and product photography circuit in the Toronto area, and probably, if it's in Toronto, probably throughout the U.S. and Europe as well. That was the kit for portraiture, and that's my go-to when I'm shooting portraiture for film.
And it, the funny thing is, you mentioned about the 150, is when you consider pricing today, the 80 mil is now the higher valued lens than the 150. Yeah. It's unreal.
Yeah, and you know, I think the primary, without going out too far off tangent, but the reason that the 80 is so expensive is because you can't find them individually. They come with the kit.
They come with the kit. Yeah. Exactly. So, I got an 82.8 when I bought my 500C.
Yeah. If you can find one, you know, the 80 CFs are about $800 these days.
Yes, which they are.
They're not cheap. And it's funny that the 150s are probably about $600. So they're a little bit cheaper, I think.
Which is still a fair chunk.
Which is still a fair chunk of change. But relative to the 80, which is surprising, just based on usage. But I guess, you know, the demographic or the style of photographers now shooting these film-based Hassies are have changed quite a bit.
But it also depends on the lens itself too. I mean, if you go with a 150 chrome, you can get them all
absolutely
the way down to a little over 150 bucks.
That's true. Chrome is a bargain.
And I'm referring
I have one of those 150 chromes. They're actually a really nice lens.
The chrome one is the one that I'm after to complete my three lens kit for.
And the chrome ones are cheaper. They just chrome. and you know what, the optical quality, I mean, if you can tell the difference between a C and a CF T-Star lens, you're lying. Because you can't.
For the C, you just make sure you throw a lens hood on.
That's
what I do.
You have to watch out for.
Right. Yeah, and anyone that says they can see difference in contrast and that sort of thing is kidding themselves that they're some kind of robotic expert on image analysis.
Or trying to rationalize spending too much money.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, you just really can't tell the difference. And, you know, one of the things that drives me nuts are people that claim that they can see this stuff on their 72 DPI crappy monitor. It's just like, just shut up and shoot, for crying out loud, you know. But anyway.
Put the smartphone away.
Yeah, put the smartphone away. But in any case, that's my go-to kit for medium format. When it comes to 35 millimeter, I'm more interested in working with the subject when it comes with portraiture and having that conversation than fiddling with gear. So when I'm shooting 35 millimeter, I'd like to go with a fully automatic electronic camera with the fastest focusing ability that I can find. Now, normally I've been the bulk of my portrait work has been with digital, and I shoot with a D4 in the digital world. But when it comes to film, it's definitely my F6. And
so not Minolta. So you're not after the fastest focusing.
I don't think Minolta is the fastest focusing these days, my friend. But I will go with. If it's film, a Nikon F6,
I'd like to add, the F6 is the newest camera that we've ever talked about on this show.
Yes, and we should do an episode about modern film cameras today.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely we should. Yeah. I think everybody here has a modern film camera, or close enough to a modern film camera.
Oh, sure. Close it's enough.
Century.
Yeah. Within the last 15 years anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this camera paired with any one of Nikon's gelded lenses, so a G series lens, is going to outperform in terms of focus speed any other film camera that's out there today.
Absolutely.
You know, it just, you can't beat it. I use this if I'm shooting portraiture, before this camera, it was my F5, and it would be in terms of a body, which John now owns. The F6 paired with an 85 1.4 Nikon G lens is my favorite go-to. For me as a portrait shooter, 85 is the focal length that I guess speaks to me, for lack of a better description.
I still regret getting rid of my 85 1.8D.
Yeah. I mean, it's a spectacular lens. I think it's one of Nikon's best lenses. Certainly their best portrait lens, and a lot will argue with the 105 and 135 F2 DC lenses, which are excellent lenses.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a little bit of an added element to use those lenses because you are using a defocus control ring, and they are the older style, mechanical autofocus system. So those that don't know and why autofocus is so quick with portraiture, the way, at least with the, my style, is because I like to have a conversation with my subject and think less about, it's less about the technical aspect of the camera and more about the conversation and figuring out who that person is, if just to make it that, to find that statement in the portrait that occurs in such a split second. That's why, for me, gear is very, very important in terms of what the gear can do. The way I look at gear is if when my existing gear is limiting my creative ability and ability to produce the output, so the image itself, then I will buy the gear that will get me there.
Absolutely.
That's my simple formula. Those that aren't familiar with Nikon's autofocus systems, in the older style cameras, or I guess in the, or I shouldn't say older style, but their first autofocus system was a mechanical body.
A linkage,
a motor.
The autofocus motor was in the body, yeah. And it was a slot screwdriver.
Exactly.
Essentially, that interfaced with the the lens.
So if you look at your, like a Nikon D300 on a digital side, an F5, an F4,
yep.
Any of the first generation autofocus, either film or digital cameras, yep. Not the pure consumer ones like the D40 or anything like that. These cameras, if you look at the lens mount plate, you'll see a spring-loaded retractable little winder, mm-hmm. and that's what's controlling the autofocus in the D series. Lenses.
That's right.
The G series are fully SWM, fully motorized, silent wave motor, very, very fast, very, very accurate. That's what I like to shoot when I'm shooting portraiture, because for me, portraiture is, if you've seen the, it's the moment before the moment is what you're trying to capture. So if you're getting a couple that's, say, kissing, for example, the emotion of that shot is just before the lips touch. And if I've seen kiss, I've missed it. So that's why I like my gear to be extremely responsive when it comes to that. Now, in terms of periphery and accessories, aside from the usual flash and that sort of thing, if anyone's into shooting portraiture, especially film, and if you're new to film and don't, you know, haven't quite grasped exposure, like you still chimp a little bit because you grew up in the digital world, go on eBay and look for some of these imitation ice lights. So thank you very much, Jerry Gahonis, but I will not buy your $500 flashlight.
Absolutely.
So I have these things here. This is called a Travor STL900, and it's a continuous LED light wand.
Looks like a stumped lightsaber.
Yes, and it's a lightsaber, and it looks like a lightsaber. It's a strip of strip bank of LEDs and a flashlight sort of thing. And if you turn it, you can turn there's basically two settings. There's a tungsten setting, so it's got tungsten colored shade that you turn, and then the other one is a white diffused light. I have two of these things. They cost me about $60 each on eBay, which is much better than the Westcott Jerry Gahonis Ice Light, which retails for about $555 US.
Wow. Yep. That hurts.
Which is an absolute ripoff and a complete joke to anyone that wants to buy something like that. Blows my mind what people do. You say professional photography, you can add 30s. It's as simple as that. But thank good. There are some really good finds on eBay, and I highly recommend, if you're going to get into portrait photography, get yourself a couple of these imitation ice light things, these LED lights, and you can shoot in continuous mode, so your meters will be a little bit more accurate and easier to use. You can see how the light's falling on your subject as you learn portraiture setups and lighting setups and that sort of thing.
Especially if you're not too familiar with shooting strobes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you always see the light fall off, and you can work with that a lot easier. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, until you understand professional studio shooting and lighting ratios and flash setups and that sort of thing, this is a great way to learn and to see real time the effect that you're having. So it's not just about the image capturing equipment, it's about the lighting equipment as well when it comes to portraiture.
And learning how to frame a face with lighting.
Absolutely.
You learn so much about lighting with something like that, a continuous light.
Absolutely.
Overhead, butterfly.
Yeah, there's so many things. And, you know, what I recommend anyone getting into portrait shooting, get yourself a continuous light setup. Line up a set of subjects that look differently, have different facial features, different shapes, body shapes, facial shapes,
young,
different
old
hairlines, young, old, etc. learn what's flattering for that type of subject, because it's not about the gear when it comes to portraiture, other than the performance of the gear.
Yeah.
You know, buy the best you can afford, as with anything that's got, you know, that's gear related, and work on lighting and setup and understanding what's flattering for your subject, what will bring out the most in your subject.
Well, I shot a portrait with a Balzi B2 of Donna once, and all I did was shoot it Tri-X, continuous light source, and pushed it to 1600. It's actually pretty remarkable what you can do with lighting and a camera that you really...
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we'll look at... who was it that took the... Was it Stephen Curry? Was it that took the Afghan girl?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
That was an FE with a 105.
2.5. And you know what? Simple setup. But like at the end of the day, that shot is nothing without the indirect shadow, the lighting,
right? That's right.
And, well, his lighting.
And without, you know, the lighting made the shot. The gear didn't.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, hey, like, don't get me wrong. 105, 2.5 isn't, it wouldn't have turned out with a different lens. It wouldn't turn out the way it did with a different lens. But at the end of the day, with photography, it's lighting first, gear second.
That's right.
Well, one of the greatest scenes that I remember from a movie I watch, The Bang Bang Club, was when they were over in Africa. Was it Africa?
Yes, South Africa.
Okay, South Africa. When he was over there, and he was taking photos of a subject. He was trying to, I guess he was trying to help the child because he was sick. I can't remember the exact reasoning behind it, but one of the things that I remember very clearly about that scene was him taking a standard tungsten lamp and holding it by the child and saying, "I need more light." And just by manipulating the light using a lamp, he was getting some phenomenal images. And it really, really told the story of how these photographers really understood their gear and the light.
It's just wild. I mean, none of that's changed today, really. And it's a really good example that you bring up that, like, you know, if you're going to learn lighting, start simple. Start with a one light setup. Yeah. And if you think you can't work with a one light setup, every time you shoot outdoors, you know that big giant ball of burning helium that's in the sky? I think
hydrogen.
That's your one light.
That's your one light setup, you know? And
painters from the dawn of man up until, well, till today with paint used that one source.
That's right. Sure. How do you think Rembrandt did it? And then we created
a Bellenchrome.
No, and we created a whole lighting setup, and you know, they would use window light and some reflective service to fill shadow in, you know, all it takes is someone to see that, to, you know, and it's the ability to see the light first is what's going to get you there. So,
Well, adults can be very easy to control and can actually hold a pose. Children
is a
not
whole,
so much.
Oh wow,
children. There's a whole bunch of children at this table right now.
Shooting children is a completely different scenario.
I think he means taking pictures of children.
Pictures of children, yes. I really should probably emphasize that.
There's half a million children right now protesting across the world right now.
About being shot? Yes, absolutely. So let's go with shooting photography of children, especially child portraits, which here I am at James's house, and he's got some pictures of his kid on the wall, which are absolutely stunning. And I'm sure that there's a lot of people out there that they pay professional photographers to get some portraits of their kids. And I decided that I was going to do it myself. And some of my favorite photos of my kids were actually shot with a 50mm lens. And one of the things I find with kids and lenses is, sure, with adults, their features are a lot bigger, so using an 85mm lens or using a 105 or even a 135 to get the depth of field and the shots and everything, I completely understand using that. But I find with kids, because they're smaller body, smaller frame, everything about them is small, you can get a little bit closer for the better framing, and nothing better than a 50mm lens to get the thin depth of field that you really want and getting some incredible images. And some of my best images, believe it or not, I got with a Pentax K1000 and an SMC M F2 50 mil lens.
Those are absolutely fantastic lenses, especially when you pull them all the way open to f2.
Oh yeah, it is just unreal. And I remember I've got a photo of actually my friend's daughter, and the clarity in her eyes, the pose that she's got, everything. And I can't really 100% attribute it to the camera and the lighting setup. She just had it was really, really vibrant. She really was very expressive. But I find that's one of the things I find with kids is they wear their emotions on their sleeve, and whatever they're feeling, mm-hmm. it's on their face.
Oh, you know, and that's it's a really interesting point that you bring up, and the fact that you were using a 50 mil focal length. And you know, a lot of people when it comes to shooting people, the kind of gut reaction, if you will, is to go with a longer lens. Yep. So a medium to longer tele lens, because you know, the longer you go, it tends to compress the yep. facial features, etc. But I do want to say that some of the best portrait work I've ever done is with a 35 millimeter lens.
Oh, yeah.
And when it comes to shooting with normal or below normal, to avoid any facial distortion, what you really need to focus on is getting the eye line of your subject on the same horizontal focus axis of your subject. Mm-hmm. And that avoids all distortion. So a lot of people don't shoot above or below the eye line of your client. Get the horizontal axis of the lens in line with the eyes of your subject, and you lose that distortion. And when you get into these, you know, normal and wider focal lengths, you are able to tell a story, a better story, better composition.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, with that shot. So
I was photographing my eldest niece, so my brother's oldest daughter, Scarlett. Oh, I can't remember how old she was at the time, but again, I grabbed the 50 millimeter, the Nikon 1.4D on my D300, just in my parents' backyard. The only light was the sun. And the images I got out of it was wonderful, because I was lying flat on my stomach.
Yep.
In the grass. And the results, well, they speak for themselves.
Yeah. And one of the things I find with kids is you want to actually get close to them. Because, yep. because well, they are smaller, but not only that, I find that kids feel more secure when you're up close, because you can actually interact with them a lot easier. And some kids, like let's say really, really young children to infants, things change in an instant. And when you're especially working with infants, you have to be there just in case, and using a long lens that you're standing far back. If something happens,
yeah, exactly,
you're not there. But if the 50 mil, you're right up close. And if something might happen, let's say your gear or even the child.
Well, they move so quickly.
Absolutely.
And so when you're shooting with a tele lens and your subject is all over the place, tracking them is a nightmare.
Yeah.
And you're going to be too focused on the chase as opposed to the actual composition. So, you know,
yeah.
Like really good point.
When you're shooting action of your kids, yeah, using a long lens is great when they're far away, because you can compress the images and you can make it, you can kind of give almost a forced perspective on everything. But when you're really shooting the portraits, you want to get up close to kids, because
absolutely.
you want to just be there, because they'll interact with you. And kids, especially young children, infants, they don't have the greatest eyesight at that point, because they're still developing. And if you're not up close, they're not going to be able to interact with you. But if
that's
you're
right
there and they can see you, and let's say you're wearing bright colors, that is like not bright that it's going to bother them, but bright neutral colors, they may react. You may get that elusive smile, and on young kids, smiling it brings out the image instantly, especially because on kids the smile is not forced.
Exactly. Well, speaking of elusive subjects and tracking subjects, sports photography is something that our good friend here, Trevor Black, has a lot of experience with.
Yes. Again, having worked for newspapers previously, I got assigned to shoot all types of sports in all sorts of situations. Often we would use the 70 to 200, 2.8 on a Nikon F4.
So that's the old D-type.
Yes, the old yep. D-type. And that at the time it was the fastest focusing, again, with that gear-driven focusing mechanism mm-hmm. that you're talking about before, James. And at the time, that was the way to go. We're talking like early 90s, mid-90s.
And just to be clear, the gear-driven autofocus on Nikon is still fast.
It's very good, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that, again, it was what was common and used for all sports at the time, basketball, hockey, and baseball, and my experiences with hockey and baseball. I was at the last, the 93 World Series in, with the Toronto Blue Jays as a film runner, and then occasionally was able to shoot my own stuff as well. And, yeah, that lens was enough to get first, because we're on the first baseline shooting towards home plate and first base and the second plate, second base, sorry. And that the 7200 was always enough range for that. So 85, 90 mil would be perfect for focusing the batter at the plate. 70 mil was just perfect for getting the baseman running to first base and sliding if need be, or the catch and that sort of thing. And 200 was a little wide for someone stealing base, but otherwise you would have a 300 mil 2.8 on a tripod with a pedal switch. So it just like automatically be pointed there. It's just like you stand on it, it's like, and just go through a roll of film really quickly. So that was the standard kit that most people used. You would get into wide angle after the game for like the, you know, the jumping shots, and everyone's like, hey, at the plate sort of thing. But yeah, 70 to 200 was the way to go. Again, the same thing for hockey. If most hockey shots are done from just above the, just ahead of the line right next to the net is
the goal line.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I just couldn't remember the color of it. Anyway, say it. It is the red line. Okay.
The red line's the center line.
Okay. Anyway, the goal line, and so you could see the opening of the net, and you can see all the action, everyone going in and trying to, you know, shoot the puck, and like the goalie trying to stop it and everything, the spray of the ice and so on and so forth. And somewhere between 70 to about 110 mil would be perfect for getting all of that, all that scene. So all the other defensemen and everything. Or if you wanted a really close up of just the goalie, you know, getting that like almost a headshot with the puck right near his face kind of thing with his glove, you'd use it at 200. And that's generally what people would set up. So, and again, 70 to 200 was the go-to lens for all of that.
I have the G-Type 70 to 200 2.8, and it was the first expensive lens that I bought. And I mostly used it for I use it for portraiture.
Oh yeah, it's a great lens for portraiture as well.
War of 1812 reenactments.
Yeah.
Because again, most of the time I was relegated to the sidelines with the spectators.
Right.
The one time I actually got it into the media pit because they saw me interacting with other reenactors as friends, and this guy who was filming for the public broadcaster over in Buffalo said, "We got a still photographer here, and this is the first time, and it looks like you know the people. Can you come in and give her a hand?"
Right.
So the
right
first on. Thing I said to her, like, "Do you have a 70-200 2.8? And she says, "Yeah, we rented one just for this." I'm like, "Fantastic. That's the lens you want to use."
Yeah, no, totally. I've shot, oddly enough, polo as well. And 70-200 works quite well with that as well.
Nice.
So there you go.
Yeah. Well, that's it for this episode. My name's Alex Lokes, and I got nothing else to say.
This is John Meadows, and after hearing about how to shoot hockey, I know I won't get pucked next time.
Oh my god. This is James Lee. Be prepared or...
get squared.
Get squared.
This is Donna Bataxi, and get out there and start shooting.
This is Mike Bataxi, and after the last episode, I've got nothing. You guys killed me.
This is Trevor Black. Remember, keep your lens up and your head down.
This is Bill Smith, and like Mike Bataxi, yeah, I'm at a loss for words this month after last month's sign-off.